Hi everybody, today is Wednesday, May 14th, 2025, and our friend Leith Maroof is back with us. Welcome back.
Great to be with you, Nima.
Leith, Donald Trump is in the Middle East and he went to Saudi Arabia and he's talking about many things in the Middle East, but here is what he said about Lebanon.
It's a once-in-a-generation opportunity to forge a Lebanon that is prosperous and at peace with its neighbors. And I think things can really happen there.
What does he mean that to be at peace with its neighbors? We know that Lebanon is not attacking anybody, but it's getting attacked by Israel. Your take on that?
Well, basically, it's for Hezbollah and the resistance to give up and to acknowledge the supremacy of the Jewish colony. This is all the wars that we saw over the last 30 years in the region, and even beyond that, all the way back to 1948, and every war since then has been about making sure the Arabs submit to the Zionist colony as a reality that they can't fight back against. And so this is what happened to Syria for 15 years, the bombardment of Syria, the war on Syria, and as we see now, the takeover by the Wahhabi death squads of Damascus. And, you know, that's all that's requested of the Arabs is to acknowledge that they are less than human. That's what Arabs are forced to accept by the West and or be killed. That's the options that we have, and this is the only reason there will be always resistance to Zionism and the United States in the region.
From what you're witnessing in Lebanon, what are they trying to do? Is that somehow similar to what the Biden administration did and before, or they're somehow changing their strategy in Lebanon?
Well, every day there is Israeli attacks on Lebanon. Yesterday, we were down in our team in the south, and we didn't have yet any idea where we're going to be filming, and suddenly just near us two different attacks. We went to the first one. There was a farmer who had stayed in the village of Al-Hula over the, you know, lost all his sheep and so forth, but he's, you know, a man that has six children, he needs to work, so he's been replanting his land, helping the other farmers replant their land, and they just decided to kill him, the Israelis, with three missiles from drones on his little scooter when he was driving a scooter in the field. So the, you know, we see that Trump is allowing Israel to attack Lebanon as much as it wants. And as we see with the ideas in the heads of the Zionists and the United States that they've now taken over Damascus, that they can now bully the Lebanese people even more, with the Lebanese being cut off from their supply routes for resistance and military. And so I don't see the Zionists backing down, and I don't see the United States stopping Israel from bombarding Lebanon.
And in Saudi Arabia, he was asked by the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia to lift all the sanctions on Syria. And it seems that he accepted. He said that he's going to lift all the sanctions. Do you see what Saudi Arabia, what does Saudi Arabia want from Syria? On one hand, we've heard that they're somehow concerned about what's going on in Syria, and right now they're trying to normalize what's going on in Syria. Where do they stand in Syria?
You know, obviously the sanctions on Syria were intended to suffocate the Syrian people and get them to revolt against the government of Bashar al-Assad, and to make them malleable, so poor and hungry that they'll take money from anybody and do anything. And that's what happened, basically. This is how you destroy nations. And I am very glad that the United States is lifting the sanctions on Syria because they were illegal, immoral. It's a war crime anyways for 15 years. And maybe if the Syrian people's food security and their livelihoods are in a better condition, they'd be better at resisting American imperialism and Israeli colonialism. So I am not one that would have come out to say the United States should continue sanctioning Syria because of the Wahhabi death squads in control of Damascus. I am a Syrian, and I've seen what happened to my people under sanctions, and using sanctions as a political tool is a war crime, and it's inhuman. Now, about Saudi Arabia, the Sauds, and with them the Americans behind them, and the British before that, since the basically end of World War One, when really the Brits got control of Al-Hijaz, where Mecca and Medina, because of the Hashemite family aligning with them and controlled Palestine. From that point on, the West has been trying to manufacture, mold a new Arab, a new Muslim, a new Jew. And as we saw, they have been successful in molding Jewish people into Zionist freaks, okay? And they've been attempting for the last 100 somewhat years to do the same to the Arabic and in larger scope, the Muslim people as a whole. And what was standing in the way of creating a new Arab that is subservient to Western imperialism and a new Muslim that is also subservient to that imperialism is the history of the capitals of culture and politics in the Arabic world, Riyadh or Abu Dhabi or Doha didn't exist 100 and somewhat years ago. The capitals of politics and culture in the Arabic world are Damascus, Baghdad, Cairo, Algiers, and Sana'a. These are where the Arabic identity is formed, and the history of rule, who rules the Arabic region, is those capitals. So in order to get to that point of creating this new Arab and this new Muslim that is subservient to imperialism, those capitals had to be destroyed. Those peoples had to be denigrated. You know, the pride that was in the heart of an Iraqi or a Syrian had to be crushed. And this new Arab, as we see, that is now taking the lead, those Gulf monarchs that are now presented as the new Arab, are exactly the worst stereotypes that are in the mind of white man of what is an Arab. And they're willingly doing that. Just like the Zionists are the worst stereotypes of any anti-Jewish comical Nazi thing that you can think about. And they're doing it willingly. And that's unfortunately where we are right now. The Muslim people outside the Arabic world, now the only capital that is really still standing is Tehran. Right, all the other Muslim capitals outside the Arabic world are under American control, whether it's Jakarta or Karachi or Lagos or Senegal, Dakar, it's all of those cities outside the Arabic world, all of those cultural capitals of Islam other than Tehran are now under American rule. So Iran now is going to have to fight this fight on behalf of all of the Muslims. Otherwise, Islam is going to go down the garbage chute like Judaism.
Leith, do we know that there is a new report in the New York Times shows that how capable Yemenis were in fighting the United States? They have shot down F-16, F-35, which is so difficult to do, and by their air defense systems. How this report shows how difficult the operation was on the part of the United States when it comes to Yemen. Do you think that the United States is able to get back, and do you see this sort of attitude in the Trump administration or the Trump himself to get back to Yemen, or they're just done with what has happened between the United States and Yemen?
Well, that report is clear that Yemen has advanced weapons that nobody knows about yet. And we've seen a few videos come out from the Yemeni armed forces over the last 48 hours hinting to all these new weapons that they have that they haven't announced yet. And a few hours ago, they targeted the Ben Gurion airport in the Zionist colony. So they're continuing their bombardment of the Zionist colony, and the United States, at least openly, is not participating in hitting Yemen. Most probably, American assets in the regions will be used by Israel, and everybody will pretend it's Israel doing it, bombardment of Yemen, just to safeguard American aircraft carriers and the major American air bases in the region, because if this war would have continued in a direct confrontation. Now it's being done by proxy. If this continued in a direct confrontation between Yemen and the United States, Yemen would have definitely sank some of these aircraft carriers. We were at the edge of having that happen. And the Al Udeid main American air base in Qatar would have been next as a target. And this would have flipped the balance of the whole region. The United States wouldn't be able to produce air jets so fast to replace any and or aircraft carriers to replace the losses that would be huge. So will the United States go back to this war? I think they never left it, but they're going to do it now in this proxy matter that I explained. And looking at what Trump just did in Riyadh in terms of I didn't talk about his speech, but he did hint to exactly what I told you, this creation of this new Arab, right? Wow, Saudi Arabia is so open now. Nobody had to push them to do it. They were good boys by themselves. And so it's clear. And while we're being told that Saudi Arabia, the den of Wahhabi fascism, is now the glorious multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-religious society, they are projecting to us by the implementation, positioning of al-Julani as the president of Syria and Wahhabi groups control Syria, that Syria, the birthplace of multiculturalism and multi-secular, sectarian coexistence in Arabic history, is now the hotbed of genocide and discrimination. You see, like what they just did, and Yemen is going to have to now to deal with all of these realities in this physical isolation, geographic isolation. But as we see, it seems like North Korea, Iran, and maybe China are still helping Yemen build up its abilities.
When it comes to the Donald Trump's visit to Saudi Arabia, it's all about investments and the way that Saudi gonna buy weapons from the United States. But when you focus on what has happened and what does the United States want from Saudi Arabia, from the region, in your opinion, what is the main objective? What is the main reasons of this sort of visit to Saudi Arabia? Is somehow normalizing, convincing that all of us remember Abraham Accords, and Donald Trump was talking about it in this visit. Do you think the main reason is that, is the Abraham Accord, and what comes, how they can manage the situation in the Middle East? Because this is the new face of the Middle East. This is not something that Donald Trump has experienced before. Your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, the Abraham Accords is seems like they want Syria to sign them, and you know, or it, that will mean, you know, Lebanon will be left standing alone as a country that's on the border of occupied Palestine that doesn't have normalization with this colony. You know, look at this. Trump and the American empire as a whole, the British before them, they took these, what we call now the royal families in these Gulf countries, from the desert out of nowhere, and they appointed them as kings and queens. In return, they're supposed to give all the oil and gas to the West. It's exactly what happened to indigenous people in the United States with the beads trade. I don't know if people know this beads trade. The conquerors came with glass beads. Indigenous people didn't know how to make glass. They thought it's something precious, and they were giving all their precious furs to the British and the French. Similarly, in South America, it was about mirrors, glass with a little bit silver on back of it, were being sold to these indigenous people that didn't know what it is in return for their gold. So the modern oil trade with the Arabic people is exactly this. Those weapons that supposedly will be delivered to the Saudis will never use, number one. Number two is they will not really ever be delivered. And number three, if they're delivered stuff, they will be broken things. I mean, I lived through the first Gulf War in 1990 in Riyadh, and I saw how the bankrupt Patriot missile system was thrown on these Gulf countries to supposedly shoot down missiles when it's designed to shoot down aircrafts and is a heat-seeking weapon, and it was already bankrupt the company. So what is required of these Arabs that are in control of these Gulf fields is to continue just taking prostitutes, drugs, and broken things from America in return for giving them all their oil and gas and staying in power. That's all it is. These people don't represent neither the Arabic peoples of their own country or the Arabic people as a whole. And unfortunately, 100 years now of attempts of the Arabic peoples to liberate themselves, the revolutions in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and all of what we saw of the Axis of Resistance have up until now failed.
Leith, as we talk, Israel is attacking Gaza. They have used bunker buster bombs in Khan Yunis. And do you see any sort of difference between Donald Trump and Netanyahu? Because it seems somehow there are some sort of differences between the two characters and the way that they want to manage the situation. How important is that, if that exists?
Yeah, it was 40 bunker busters, 40 GBUs fired on the courtyard of the hospital, the European hospital. I mean, the images are, I can't anymore watch these videos. I just scroll through the news and I don't watch the videos because it's unbelievable. It's being done on purpose. Even now, this, you know, we're all being told that it's normal to watch snuff videos, you know, when it was a criminal prosecution to watch snuff videos, but it's now a stream of them on social media. And only because it's Palestinians, Arabs in general, Muslims, we don't even count. You know, if it was a video of torture of a dog, we'll go to jail if we share it on social media. Anyways, and just 2 days before was the attack on a Palestinian journalist who was injured in an attempted assassination, sitting in his hospital bed. A drone goes through the window and assassinates him. I mean, this is beyond, you know, I think the wildest nightmares, not dreams, of anyone on this planet, of how, you know, despicable humans can be. This is what Zionists are doing. And it seems like, you know, Trump, all that we hear about this fight with Netanyahu and what have you, I think it's all theatrics. There was the release of the American Israeli soldier that was captured on October 7th. We saw those celebrations in New Jersey, flying the Israeli flag, very little American flags in the streets. And Trump was supposed to open the borders and let the aid come into Gaza in return, and nothing happened. There was only 4 trucks of medicine delivered by the Red Cross minutes before the release of this American-Israeli soldier. So why would Trump need to change the policy? I mean, the Saudis, Qataris, and Emiratis will throw all their money at him no matter what. The Syrian state is under their control. The Jordanians and Egyptians will do nothing. And so why would he try to confront Netanyahu? This is a big question. Like, anyone that thinks that there's a difference between what Biden and Trump are doing, or their positionality on Palestine, show us tangible things. I don't care about words. Words is all theatrics. We're all living in a reality TV show. This is what the news is in the West. It's worse than the Housewives of Atlanta in terms of how it's produced. But it's dramatized, for mass consumption, when in reality nothing changes.
And the talks, Donald Trump is headed to Qatar and he's going to talk with Hamas indirectly, it seems. What do they want from Hamas? Just the prisoners? Nothing beyond that?
I mean, for the Israelis, they want the destruction of Hamas, the defeat of Hamas, the exit of Hamas from Gaza, and basically to surrender. That's what the Israelis want. That's what Netanyahu wants. And that's what he's pushing for. And otherwise, he would have stopped months ago if it was about return of the hostages, if not even the first week of October 2023, after Al-Aqsa flood began. Hamas already offered the release of all the Israeli prisoners in exchange for Palestinian prisoners, and the Israelis rejected it 3 days after October 7th. And they've rejected it since then. So I think Netanyahu, since he has the green light from the West, he has the silence of the official Arabic states, other than resistance groups on the ground like Hezbollah. There's nobody to fight back and defend the Palestinians. And therefore, he's going to continue on this path. I'm not saying that he's going to be successful, but because today Hamas released 2 videos of operations against Israeli soldiers inside Gaza. One of them with a bunch of Israeli soldiers inside a house. They're setting up all these explosives to blow it up, and they were targeted with anti-personnel fire, and the whole house exploded on top of the Israeli soldiers. Another is a patrol. Platoon was targeted again with mines under the ground of a booby-trapped field, and they blew them all up. So Hamas is still resisting. The Israelis would probably be able to kill all the Palestinian civilians in Gaza before they can defeat Hamas. This is reality, okay? And as we see, it seems like the Israelis are fine with killing all the Palestinian people.
Leith, do you think that the main problem is with the name Hamas? Or because if you think about what the texture of the society in Gaza, it's not just, you cannot separate Hamas from Gazans. They're part, this is the same thing. And do you think that just by just removing the name, that would solve the problem in the mind of the West? Because we know that, if you remember, China tried to bring all the factions together in those sort of talks. And do you think something of that category is possible to do? Is that doable for the, if we assume that all these countries are interested in a ceasefire, in a peace talk with between the two parties, between the United States and Israel on one part and Gazans and Palestinians on the other part?
Well, Mahmoud Abbas is going to be in Lebanon, I think, tomorrow. If I'm not wrong, he already is talking about disarming Palestinian resistance in the Palestinian camps in Lebanon. And the Palestinian Authority security forces have killed close to 70 Palestinians in the West Bank since October 7th. So they are as criminal as the Israelis. And, you know, this is a man that has sold his soul, sold his nation to the Zionists and the Americans. I hope somebody here in Lebanon, if he has a, Mahmoud Abbas has a press conference, that somebody throws a shoe on his face at least. But, you know, so there's no way you can have a unity with a collaborator. That's impossible. I mean, the Palestinian resistance groups, other parties that are part of the Palestinian Liberation Organization have for over a decade now been trying to create a unity government and include all the political parties in the PLO. And the dictatorship of Mahmoud Abbas is not allowing it to happen. So there's not going to be a change on that front as long as Mahmoud Abbas lives and the Palestinian Authority is still in existence. So what we see, you know, when you talked about how all of Gaza, you know, supports Hamas, people must understand that this doesn't mean that everybody is, a Muslim traditionalist that is a member of Hamas. But as Palestinian, that you want to resist the Zionist colony, you look around, you see that the most successful project is Hamas, therefore you join them. And you carry arms to protect your family and protect your country. That's how it works. People are not, Hamas now includes the vast majority of Palestinians in Gaza, not because everybody there is supports the Islamic positionality of politics in Hamas, but they support the resistance and they see Hamas as the best way to carry arms and fight this fight. I don't know what to say here. I think the Chinese and the Russians have given up right now on this. And look at what's happening to the Palestinians inside Syria. You know, over the last few weeks, the HTS has been kidnapping leadership of Palestinian groups like Palestinian Islamic Jihad and the PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. We saw that led to HTS finding the body of an Israeli soldier that was killed in 1982 in a battle with the Syrian military inside Lebanon, the most famous battle, Nabi Yaqub battle, which was the largest tank battle since World War II, where Syria defended and won this battle. Anyways, look, this to see how these other Palestinian groups like PIJ, PFLP, Hamas, and so on are being targeted everywhere they are, it's hard to think that suddenly Fatah will agree to negotiate and have a unity government there.
Mahmoud Abbas is going to Lebanon on an invitation from the Lebanese government, you mean?
Yes. And he's coming basically to talk about the situation in the refugee camps. And you see, because the Israelis and the Americans ultimately want the naturalization of Palestinian refugees where they are. So to you know, give Palestinians in Lebanon Lebanese citizenship and then strip them of their right to return to their homeland in Palestine. And, you know, this is going to happen in Syria most probably also. And Syria holds a huge, you know, almost 500,000 Palestinian refugees. And then that will be followed by the other Arab countries. And so if Lebanon is refusing to do, accept this, it will have to pay a price for it.
Yeah. I was wondering how they can consider any sort of credibility to Mahmoud Abbas, and because he's not representing anybody. I don't know if in the West Bank, does he have any sort of credibility in the West Bank right now?
Zero credibility. Most of the Palestinians, even that are members of Fatah, don't see him as representative of them. You know, the people that are in Fatah right now and persist on staying in Fatah, it's like a family heirloom situation. Their dad was in Fatah, their grandfather was in Fatah, they're going to stay in Fatah. But it's not because they support Mahmoud Abbas and or his positionality. It's a very tribal situation. And we see a lot of the people that were involved in armed wings of Fatah that are not part of the Palestinian Authority security forces, all defecting basically and seceding from the control of Mahmoud Abbas and the Fatah command. And therefore, inside the West Bank, in every refugee camp, every time there's confrontations between the Palestinian Authority and or the Zionist troops entering the cities and the camps, you see a unified fighting force, local unified fighting force, that includes Fatah fighters, that includes Hamas, Islamic Jihad, the FLP, just like in Gaza. In Gaza, the Fatah armed wings are very involved in the fight also. So you see, there's a schism. Now, there's kind of like a fight over the brand of Fatah. And each person is saying, I represent Fatah. So it's really Mahmoud Abbas, his clique, and the Palestinian Authority do not represent anybody. They probably don't even represent their wives, okay?
Leith, whenever I see Al Giolani and the way that he's behaving, I remember Zelensky in Ukraine. Zelensky came to power, he had some sort of mission. He destroyed everything in Ukraine. And he's just on his way to get out of his position. Do you see the same sort of agenda behind Giolani and his team?
Oh, yes, for sure, for sure. I mean, his number one job is to make Syria unable to affect anything around it. And that can only happen if Syria is broken up and is not self-sufficient, is poor, you know, is unable to produce a culture. Look, you know, the most watched TV shows in the Arabic world, dramas and so on, are Syrian. The most listened to music is Syrian. Now that's all going to be done, gone. What is going to happen? What is Syria going to be doing if all of its architecture and its archaeological sites looted and destroyed? What happened to the museums? I don't know. Nobody's telling me what's happening to the museums of Syria. And if the country is broken up to a Kurdish colony and, you know, the Druze in the south and Alawis in the east, what country will that be when all the resources are in separate places and the country doesn't have sufficiency in anything, meaning just the few cities that are in the center that will fall, become Syria after chopping it up? So I think he definitely is doing exactly the job that he's asked to do, fragment the Syrian society, create so much distrust and hate between the groups that they cannot coexist again, create geographic isolation between the regions, make it that people can travel. It used to be that in the after World War One, that the Arabs were complaining about having to cross borders between each Arabic state. Now it's going to be that a Syrian from the coast can never see the east part, and the guy from the east part can never see the south. And so it's that in itself molds new identities, and that's what they're trying to do. Erase the cumulative history, oral history, and identity that exists in the region to make it into fragments of neighborhoods that can't protect themselves.
Do you see that this the attempts on the part of Saudi Arabia and Turkey, are they going to be able just to capture those parts of Syria that are now occupied by Israel? Do you think that that could be possible in a long run? Is that possible to just somehow force Israel to get out of that, those regions?
I think it's impossible. You know, the Israelis are purposefully occupying all the watershed of the Golan Heights. That's their priority. Now, because, you know, all the water actually in Lebanon, in Palestine, and in South Syria, and in Jordan, it comes from the watershed of the Golan Heights. So with the French giving the British and the Zionists the Hula Valley in north of Palestine, it used to be part of Lebanon, giving them that in the 1930s, you know, allowed the Israelis to take all of the water coming from the Golan towards the Hula Valley. And then with the occupation of the West Bank, and the that meant control of all of the Jordan River and the Sea of Galilee, which are all coming also the southern watershed of the Golan Heights. And now with the occupation of the Yarmouk River Basin and all the slopes, the western slopes, the eastern slopes of the Golan Heights, that means control of that. So that's really what the Israelis want. Now, at any moment, they can cut off water from Syria, from Lebanon, from Jordan, from the West Bank, and, you know, get the whole country to go thirsty. And this is where the, you know, kind of they're holding them from their sack, basically, right? And that's they're not going to let go of that, no matter what.
Yeah. Just to wrap up this session, Dave, can we see Hezbollah right now in Lebanon doing something in the near future in terms of what's, because we know somehow they're trying to divide the government and Hezbollah, and they're trying to put a lot of pressure on the government in Lebanon. But do you see this division as it's getting more substantial, more they would be more disconnected, or you see somehow they're going to merge in as their sort of goals coming along, the goals on the part of Hezbollah and the government? How do you see the situation, the communication between the two parts in Lebanon?
Yeah, we've had these local and municipal elections over the last week, and they're going to continue for another week over the country. And this was supposed to be kind of a test of what is the popularity of Hezbollah and resistance now after the genocide in Gaza and the destruction of much of Lebanon with this war. And so I think the Americans and the Saudis and Emiratis and Qataris and everybody that put money into this election were hoping for a ground shift that will strengthen this puppet new president and puppet new prime minister in their fight with Hezbollah, or trying to coerce Hezbollah into giving its weapons up. And of course, those were all delusions, because the country is very divided because of the civil war and the wars after wars since the 1948 here, that most people will not forget. They will not also flip sides easily. And in fact, the Hezbollah has won every municipal seat or mayoral position that they have controlled before the war, and anyone that they ran a candidate in. Similarly, that is for Amal, the other Shia party that is aligned with them, and the Druze, Jumblat family and their socialist party also were not shaken out of their power positions in the mountain. And finally, when we're talking about the Christian parties, that the Saudis and the Israelis were hoping that the Falange and the Kataib will have more seats, more municipalities, and take away from the Patriotic Movement party, and that didn't happen. So there was no change in power in the municipalities and the cities and the mayoralships. In fact, if there was any change, we saw changes where anti-imperialist took a few more seats. It's not a huge difference, but that shows you that the war didn't work if this was the intended purpose of it. And so what is President Aoun and Prime Minister Salam gonna do now? They don't have the political base to actually confront Hezbollah. And also they don't have the military base to do so. They don't have the military power to do so. And the military will revolt against them if they try to use it as a weapon against Hezbollah. And therefore, we see the continuation of Israeli attacks on a daily basis in Lebanon as the only option and possibility of not allowing any reconstruction funding to come into the country to help it. So basically, a continuation of the Caesar Act against Syria, the sanctions against Syria, but now only on Lebanon.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Leith, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Talk to you soon, Nima.
Talk to you.